adding together wavelengths of 50 and 70. If not, you and I have a little bit of difference of opinion here. If that was wavelengths of 72 ohm line, I'm doubtful, because the antenna itself is a pure resistance with no reactance. The way transmission line works, you're going to be getting impedance inversions, you're going to be going around the chart, you're going to be doing all kinds of things, but every quarter wavelength of line will again have no reactance. Started off with no reactance, every quarter wave step will be some resistive component, but no reactance in the 72 ohm line, if you're only analyzing 72 all by itself. And so, 0.562, if that was 70 ohm length, I don't think that can be a zero reactance in the 72 ohm line at the input end. Maybe I've got that backwards. K1FC, K2LAW in the TechNet.
1 second, Dick, you got it. See if I got it. Yeah, Dick, the antenna, the 50 ohm line is connected to the antenna, not the 72 ohm line to the antenna, the 50 ohm. In other words, you got the antenna, then the 50 ohm line, then to extend it, he extended it with a 72 ohm piece of wire to the shack deck, over.
Okay. When you first told me, you told me that the transmitter came with a length of 0.15 of 50 ohm line. I assumed that that was a pendant cable connected to the transmitter, the 50 ohm line, it's on the antenna. Okay. I've got it doubly backwards. I'll be quiet. You guys go ahead.
Yeah, Roger, the antenna comes with the 50 ohm line, over.
Okay, the way I interpreted it, that's why I got the answer that I did.
Okay, makes more sense. I've got to rework it because I got it backwards. I thought I heard Mel saying that the 50 ohm cable is connected to the transmitter, that the transmitter came with 50 ohm cable. I thought I heard those words.
No, that's why I said that they extended it. In other words, after you put the antenna up, connected the 50 ohm cables, according to this, and it didn't reach the shack, so that's when they added the 72 ohm piece of cable to the 50 ohm to get it to the shack, over.
That makes a lot more sense. I should have thought of that.
Okay, so plotting it the way I did you plot it, or you want to try it again, Dick?
I didn't plot it, but now that I understand the problem a little better, you start off with exactly like you said, a 2 to 1 standing wave ratio, 0.15. Be right with you.
Hey, Mel. If you have the 72 ohm at 0.562 wavelength, what do you get for an input piece?
That's the problem. We don't know that. I knocked myself off the air. Oh, no, okay. I had to look here for a second. I don't know the length of the 72 ohm line. He didn't specify that. The only specifications I have is the 100 plus J0 of the antenna, the 0.15 50 ohm cable, and then the additional 72 ohm piece of wire that was added. And the question just asked is, what is the VSWR of on the 72 ohm line by that finally winds up in the shack that's connected to this system? So I don't know the length or anything about the 72 ohm line. That's why a little tricky problem. That's why I believe this is a homework assignment, and I tried to plot it all out on the Smith chart, and if the plot looks good, over.
Yeah, but I don't think it's determinant, because whatever length of 72 ohms, you can trim it and get all sorts of different answers. There's not a single, it's not like, okay, now you come up with a number. You can try a number where you have zero reactance. The zero reactance number I had is 0.562. But if I have a different length, then I get some combination of resistance and reactance as the apparent input piece.
Oh, I don't know, you know, because look, if I work the problem, in other words, up to the 50 ohm, before the 72 ohm line is connected, we have 34 ohms minus 24 ohms on the existing system with the antenna and the 50 ohm line at that point. Then I thought to myself, if I was to take that 34 minus 24 and normalize it to a 72 ohm line, just any length of 72 ohm line, what happens? And, well, I come up with a 0.47 minus J, 0.33. Do you agree with that at this point, over?
Okay, well, I'm using my program for doing it. That's what I'm trying to see how it works compared to a Smith chart. And so what I have to do is put in the wavelength and then see what numerically and get a numerical readout as to what the input impedance is.
Okay, how about, do you agree that it'll be about 34 ohms minus 24 ohms approximately up to the 50 ohm cable before we add the 72, over?
Yeah, that we agree exactly, almost virtually exactly. I have 33.7 and minus 23.9, which is as good agreement as you could ever get.
Okay, now, if you were to normalize that point now by adding 70, putting the 72 ohm line, if you normalize that and divide that by 72, you would get 0.47 minus J 0.33. Do you agree with that, over?
Yeah, okay. Well, the thing is that my program, I don't have to normalize it. It works absolute.
Okay, because I'm doing this on a Smith chart by hand. This is the whole idea of this new. Do it by hand on a Smith chart as they did in 1939. The dinosaurs we are. My daughter calls me a dinosaur. Please excuse the expression. But this is done before we had computer programs. And we're doing this with pencil and a straight edge and a compass. Now I took the point after I normalized it. And that point on the Smith chart of 0.47 minus J 0.33. And now I swung a circle using that point. And Val just brought the line down to the SWR scale, straight down. And it reached 2.5 to 1. That's how I determined it. If I'm wrong, well, that's, I don't know how I could have gone wrong with it, because it looks right on the Smith chart. Go ahead.
I think he's right on. I get 2.4. Three, close enough. I do it as an exact calculation. As I see it, 100 ohms of antenna and 0.15 wavelength of 50 ohm cable gives you a input impedance at the junction of the 50 and the 72. That impedance coming down from the 50 ohm 0.15 is 33.7 resistive minus J24. Then mathematically, if you want to, you can always figure out what is the standing wave ratio. I take it back. What is the reflection coefficient? You can calculate reflection coefficient by subtracting Z0 and dividing it by some Z0. So if you take 33.7 and that minus J24, that complex number, subtract 72 ohms from it, take the exact same complex number in the denominator, add 72 ohms to it, do the division, you end up with a reflection coefficient of 0.417. If you calculate that, this is where I get 2.429, which that's with a machine that supposedly is doing it with 10 decimal places. With your Smith chart, after all of those conversions and flipping over and whenever else, you got 2.5. I think you're right on, Mel. Thank you, Mel.
W2VL repeater system.
Yep, that's why. I know, Dick. I always, like I've said many a time, I will visualize the thing first. You know, I made a sketch on a paper, and I said, now, how do I fit this to the Smith chart? Because I've always found if I can fit the picture onto the Smith chart and then do it mathematically, and I came out with what you just said, if I first got it visually on a Smith chart and then I work it out mathematically, I know I'm in the ballpark real close. And I thought that this was a good demonstration, for a while I sat and I looked at it and I said, how did I put this onto the Smith chart? You know, mathematically, yes. I can do it like you basically punch it into my calculator and do it the same way. But how do you make a visual out of this thing on a Smith chart? So I thought about it and I said, gee, this is an odd looking thing, but it looks good on a Smith chart, Dick, over.
Yeah, when I think.
Go ahead, Jeff. Fred.
Yeah, the curious thing is that I get 2.4 is what I get with that wavelength, which has the minimal reaction. 2.4 on the input and 2.4 on the output, which is kind of curious. I'm not sure what the significance is, because if I change the wavelength, then I get a little bit different answer. But that's what everything is symmetrical.
Yeah, the original question was standing wave ratio at one point in that transmission system. I think the answer is, what standing wave ratio does the 72 ohm line see? Since we know by way of the exact length of the 50 ohm cable and in theory the exact impedance of the antenna, we therefore know the exact impedance at the input end of the 50 ohm cable. We know we're connecting 70 ohm cable to it. So what standing wave ratio does the 70 ohm cable see? In reality, you would calculate a certain reflection coefficient at that point for the forward going signal. However, because there is now some real amount of reflection, that real amount of reflection is coming back to the signal generator. That signal generator, in theory, is 50. Real transmitters are not. In theory, is 50, and 70 ohm cable is connected. So there's another complicated reflection that takes place there. And ultimately, there's all kinds of signals bouncing back and forth in that poor piece of 70 ohm cable. I think the magnitude is approximately that which would occur with a 2.4 and a half or so standing wave ratio. The next step in the problem would be, and this is where your program would really shine, Fred, is if they told you the length of the 72 ohm cable, you'd now know the exact impedance that the transmitter is receiving, but I think changing the length of the 70 ohm cable would not change the standing wave ratio in the 70 ohm cable. I think that's true, but I wouldn't bet a whole lot of money on it. Give me a little rebuttal on that one, Fred.
You're absolutely right. Changing the length of, see, this is where I interpreted the question differently than you did. At the end of the 72 ohm cable, I get 2.4. Now, if it were, I deliberately did not put any more decimal points in here because I thought it was superfluous. So your 2.429 may be perfectly okay. It's always 2.4, but at the starting end, the impedance that you see is a function of how long that 72 ohm cable is.
Yep, I think we've learned something by this. And there are sexy ways of putting together 50 and 72 ohm cable. What the Brits have done in a couple of their articles in their technical section of radio communication, their equivalent of QST, the RSGB, I do remember seeing a pivotal article, a zillion years ago, it must have been 20 or so years ago, where in theory you can take any antenna impedance within reason, any transmitter output impedance within reason, and you've got chunks of 50 ohm and 70 ohm cable, and if you alternate the 50 and the 70 ohm cables the right way with the right length of the alternates, you can do a essentially lossless match impedance-wise. I mean, the cables themselves, yeah, they're running with some biswar, but at least you can keep the antenna happy and the transmitter happy. And so I believe they were able to synthesize with that system an impedance match for an antenna that's anything from something like 20 ohms to 200 ohms. They could make it all work out by alternating lengths of 50 and 70 ohm cable. Kind of a sexy system. The math that went into it really is a little bit complicated. They had made a bunch of simplifications and came out with some good ballpark figures as to how to do it, which worked out to the nearest, 5% error most of the time. It was a fun article. I wish I could locate it now. Back to you, Mel. K2KEY, K2 KQLIW on the TechNet.
Hey, very good. This is K2KEY. All right. Should we, should the person that's listening to this, should we let them submit this answer to the problem, the Smith chart answer to the problem, Dick, and make him maybe the hero of the class? I'm sure some teacher dreamed this one up, you know, for a class question, you know, a homework question. So should we say that we can let him be the genius of the class, and this sounds like a Smith chart, a apical representation of how to do this problem on a Smith chart, over.
Sounds pretty good. And I would give you a 97% confidence factor that we've got it pretty close to right. You can never be 100%, because when it comes to signals bouncing around in cables, my goodness, can you get in trouble. The smartest electrical engineer I know in the whole country of South America is this guy, Manfred Mortenwig, can't think of his call letters right now, in La Salina, Chile, is where he lives. And he does a lot of the electrical engineering for the European Southern Observatory main optical set of telescopes in Chile. And boy, they've got a bunch of really massive telescopes that are doing some great work. And he has, from time to time, called upon to find faults in a transmission line that's buried in the ground for thousands of feet, and somewhere along the line, a rodent dug into it, or something pierced the cable, and by various techniques, without using a TDR, he didn't have a time domain reflectometer at his disposal. So by making a series of measurements with a swept frequency signal generator at one end of the cable, he figured out where the fault in the cable was. He called in the backhoe, they dug it up at that exact spot, and within a foot or two, he was right. So here's a guy who's got a track record of living on top of a mountain where he doesn't have a radio shack within 100 miles of where he is. It's a two-day drive to get to one, and they don't have a radio shack in Santiago, Chile, the main capital of the place. They've got a couple of electronic stores, so with toothpicks and chewing gum and all kinds of crafty ideas on top of the mountain, he cannibalizes various things and gets them back onto the air over and over again. So here's a guy who's got a real good track record. He's got the equivalent of an amateur extra class license in Chile, XQ2, FOD, I think it is. Anyhow, I'm still having trouble remembering his call letters. A real smart guy. However, in all of the emails that passed back and forth between me and him over about a three-year period, the big mistake I made one day is stating my theory that in a transmission line, the signal that flows forward and the signal that flows in reverse are thoroughly independent events. But as long as this transmission line is not at the point of arc over, those two waves, even though they came from the same signal generator, and one of them is due to reflection at the far end of the cable, those two signals are thoroughly separate events. Well, on that particular area of electrical engineering, he's got the exact opposite opinion. He's positive the cable mixes them together. You get a composite impedance at the input. You get a composite impedance at every position along the line, and those are not independent events. To me, that is dead wrong. But he has come up with a whole set of mathematics that works for him. When he adapts all the I's and crosses all the T's, he gets the right answers using the wrong raw data. I'm convinced it's wrong. I mean, the example that I give is that I drop a pebble in the north side of my puddle of water. I watch the waves travel to the south. I drop a pebble in the south side of the puddle of water. I watch a wave progress to the north. If I drop two pebbles simultaneously, I watch those two waves fold through each other with no interaction if the signals are strong enough so you don't get white caps on the waves, if you know what I mean. I've seen that happen with tapping my guy wire and watching a pulse go along it. I've seen it in a puddle of water. And with my set of mathematics within coax cable, I'm sure it works. And he has come up with this completely opposite set of math that works for him. and somehow he made it work. So what really goes on at the molecular level and how you analyze it, wow, there's more than one way to skin a cat. I wonder if you've ever heard a story like that one, Fred. K1FC, and then pass it over to Mel, KQLIW and the TechNet.
No, I haven't. It's not something I've given a lot of thought to. But my suspicion is that it's a situation where you can analyze something, and I've seen other situations, although I can't give a good example off the top of my head, where you can analyze something two different ways, and they seem to be quite different, and yet you will end up with the same answer. It's because they both were looking at the same problem slightly differently, but by the time you had to go through all the math, everything canceled out. And I'm kind of wondering whether that might be the situation here, that everything canceled out, even though he's looking at it in an entirely different way. Over to you there, Mel.
I agree with you 100%, Fred. This is K2KEY. I guess Dick and I have had this discussion a number of times, and XQ2FOD. I built his power supply, switching power supply, and I made some redesigns on it, and I tried to discuss it with him, some changes over, because I found one or two ways that you could simplify it, and worked quite well, but for some reason he didn't want to sanction it at all. And yet, when I submitted it to the ARRL, I noticed that when they built the project, that more or less they also came up with the same result. So there most likely is a number of ways. I mean, just a quick example of solving the same problem, getting the same answer or a completely different answer using, you know, similar parameters. That's where the problem is. I have always found that if I take the Smith chart, this is as simple as you can go, because 1939, you know, they didn't have a handheld, they didn't have a calculator. I don't think they were working with, as I say, with straight edge compass here, and maybe a slide rule, basically, on most all the projects. Everything, I'm sure, right through World War II was all done by that method. And a number of times in electrical engineering, electrical engineering professor, in fact, he once said, he says, I'll bet you, he says, that Mr. Schneider, meaning me, will come up with an answer to this question, because everybody was bouncing it every which way, and I showed him, basically, I solved it, basically. I guess I've been indoctrinated so much into the Smith chart over the years, going way back, as I did. You know, I went to school here at Brooklyn Technical High School, and we learned basic electrical engineering here. So I guess I've been indoctrinated into the Smith chart, that I always go to the Smith chart first before I go to the math. Then I try to make the math fit the Smith chart, I guess. And so you may be right. I think Dick and I discussed this a number of times, that I go by the visual first and then try to work the math backwards from that. In fact, sometimes check myself with a slide rule yet, because again, I'm so used to it. Again, I'm a dinosaur. So, Dick, I think we agree that sometimes the visual on it is best, and then try to explain the visual, because you look at this visually, you can't, deny that this is an apical example. Over.
A6DPZ. Okay, go ahead, Harold.
Yeah, I was just listening. I just want to make one comment. You mentioned impedance transformation by using a Q-section, and another way is by using a tank circuit and stepping up on the tuned tank circuit to your two different impedances for impedance transformation. So right there is an example of two ways of doing things to come up with the same answer.
Well, there's a lot more than that. The tank circuit is a nice approach when it comes to on paper. When it comes to the real world, would you like to open up the middle of a transmission line and put in a cavity resonator and tune it just right, with the input line and the output line tapped in just the right places, and then continue back in the transmission line and do that all outdoors? I know the answer in many cases is no. Whereas if you use the right impedance of a quarter wave matching section, sometimes you can get there. By using shunt stubs that are either short-circuited or open-circuited, connected in the middle of your transmission line with a T connector, weatherproofing that is pretty easy. So a guy who's smart at putting short and open stubs in just the right position of a transmission line, he can correct almost anything. So that stub, a single stub sometimes can do it, maybe not over a great bandwidth, but at least at a fixed frequency. It's a beautiful solution. When it comes to more than one way of analyzing, which is what Fred was saying, I guess you could say, if someone asked you, is a light wave a particle or a wave? And the right answer probably is yes. If you got enough mathematics to back you up, you can analyze it as a particle. You could use Huygens' principle, Fermat's principle, I'm trying to think of a couple of other guys. You put it all together, you can analyze it with Huygens you can analyze it as particles, with Snell's law you can analyze it as waves of certain refractive indices and so on. If you carry out either chunk of mathematics far enough, you'll come up with the right answer. And so both of them work. Where I'm getting myself in quite a bit of trouble over the last month is that I published an article in the Microwave Reflector on the subject of what's the ideal side lobe levels for high-gain Yagi antennas. And I compared it to the aperture distribution for the highest gain you could get out of a parabolic dish antenna. So a parabolic dish antenna has a physical area you can see. It's got an effective area, which is a function of the way you illuminate the dish with the feed horn. And if you had an ideal enough feed horn, you could get 100% aperture efficiency. Well, and when, as you tune a Yagi has a certain effective capture area. It has a certain distribution, amplitude distribution. And when you adjust the Yagi correctly, it is a refractor where the dish is a reflector. But in either case, it has a real area, an effective area, and the area has a certain aperture distribution, obvious by the amplitude of the side lobes. So therefore I speculated that when you tune a Yagi, a long Yagi, for best possible gain, will have side lobes 17.5 dB down. Because that's what happens with a uniform distribution on a circular aperture for a dish and for an optical telescope. It's a so-called airy disc that you get out of an optical telescope that's diffraction limited. Well, that created a furor. My goodness, where is this crazy theory coming from? Up until then, a whole lot of people have been tuning Yagis with their optimization programs to try to make all side lobes disappear, which in my opinion is a futile effort. Sacrifice a lot of gain in your Yagi when you do that. So, they've got various professors writing me articles now. I mean, Mel got 72 emails last week. I'm getting a whole lot of emails now from these highfalutin guys in Queensland, Australia. And I almost feel like I'm being attacked. I'm having a little trouble defending myself. I wondered why I'm doing this. In this situation, what would you do, Fred? You've been there. K1FC, KQLAW on the tech there.
You know, when you're talking about Yagis, I was just kind of curious. I got an email today with some photos of a Japanese Yagi antenna for 75 meters. It's a five-element rotatable Yagi on top of a, I don't know, 200-foot tower or something like that. It looks like quite an installation. I was just kind of curious. On the different ways of doing anything, just reminded me of a story when I was in college about one of the professors. For some reason or other, it may have been Norbert Wiener, but it could have been another one instead. It's been so long. But he does a proof, and he kind of skips over a key element of the proof of something. And so one of the students raised his hand and said, you know, is there another way of doing it? The professor stood there, thought for a minute, and said, you're right, there is, turned around and wrote down the final result, still not explaining anything at all. So that was what came to mind. Now maybe that's what Bell used as a class. Go ahead, Bell.
That's an old gimmick, you know. They used to go to sometimes a demonstration, electronic demonstration, and they'd have it was a demonstration by a company called, Hikigami. Hikigami came out with a scope that, you know, they went ahead and made a copy, a cheap copy of a certain Tektronix scope. And they had it set up that they were showing to do certain analysis with the scope how much quicker and better it was to do it. Of course, they had the answer, you know, the problem. The problem was set up, so it's, you know, it was a setup, as they say, for everything, so that, oh, here, see this particular measurement? Well, you just put this probe on, see the scope jumps, and it would indicate exactly what the answer should be. Of course, it's all fixed. And that's the same thing. They'll take the answer and they'll figure out how to make the problem fit the answer rather than work it the other way around. In other words, give the problem, figure out the answer. They take the answer first and then manipulate the math around and manipulate whatever the situation is around so that it will work. And this has been an old gimmick for years, you know, in different industries, how they, you know, take the result and then work it backwards from the result rather than the other way around. So, Dick, you know, you're knocking your head against the wall. Believe me, some of the things people say to me, I just wind up saying, okay. And I smile to myself. I said, I'm not going to pursue this because you're never going to convince them. You're just never going to get a person that you're going to be able to sit down and say, well, show me, you know, go step by step. And that's why I more or less, you know, did this step by step on the Smith chart so that I could give a demonstration of it and a visual demonstration of it. And this way, you know, I could say with the math, to do this mathematically is a jumble of a lot of mathematical procedures. And I tried, Dick, I think the answer is keep it as simple as possible. Do you agree? Over.
Most of the time, yes. Not always. There's a number of cases in history where somebody was doing an experiment to confirm a theory as to how Mother Nature really worked, particularly with light, refraction of optics, and X-rays, and things like this, as these theories 100 years ago, 200 years ago, were being developed. People would run various experiments, and the main purpose of running the experiment was to confirm their particular pet theory. In a number of cases, when somebody reviewed their textbooks, their notebook, their engineering notebook, 100 years later, you find out that the guy made a couple of measurements that fell off the line that he's drawing, if you know what I mean. And the guy refused to put that into the data set because he assumed it was a maverick measurement. In reality, the so-called maverick measurement contained the information that gave you the next level of understanding of what was really going on. So a smarter person tries never to throw away any data. When he really does an objective measurement, he should include all the data, even if it doesn't quite fit your theory. On top of that, there are other cases where you think the problem is very complicated, and there are some huge simplifications you can make, and you can get an answer that's 95% correct. The best example I can think of that, it was when it comes to the mechanical resonance of a great big parabolic dish ground station. Lots of people have worried about all the crisscross girders, all the support structure that's in the dish and the azimuth elevation tilting mechanism. There's some very simple techniques you can use where you know the total mass of the dish, the approximate diameter, is it made out of steel or aluminum? You go to a very simplified formula, and you say, yeah, it's going to have a mechanical resonance at 2 cycles per second. And when you plug in all of the data of all of the variables, you end up with 1.95 cycles per second instead of 2. And the 2 is good enough when it comes to saying, should I go to approach A or approach B as to what's the most cost-effective way of building this thing. So there's a lot of fun with that. In the case of Yagi's, boy, the average person is really mystified as to where the gain is coming from. In the case of a short Yagi with three elements, could analyze it as a three-element filter, a three-pole filter, with certain coupling coefficients between those driven element, director, and reflector. You can come up with a pretty good answer as to how strong is the signal on the director and the reflector, what's the phase angle between it and the driven element, and therefore you can, by superposition, figure out what is the wave going to look like at a point in free space, some far, some distance away from the antenna. So short Yagis, you can analyze them as a three-pole filter. When it comes to a 16, a 24, or a 102-element Yagi, it is my belief, although that phenomenon is there, it is not the dominant phenomenon. I'm convinced that your director string is a slow wave structure that works by refractive optics, and it is an end-fire effect that really synthesizes a double convex magnifying glass is what it's synthesizing, but it's doing it with only a skeleton of materials. You could, if you want to, take a great big chunk of foam, cut it into the shape of a double convex magnifying glass, and it operated at 432 if you want to. It would have a lot of wind load, but that refractor would work like a charm, and it would give you the gain it's supposed to give. You can then go the next step and say, okay, I don't want to really choose this high-density foam, which is expensive and heavy. I'm going to use the low-density foam, but I'm going to bury these great big washers in it, in the foam, and I'm going to change the density of the washers. A whole lot of population of washers near the center of the lens and very few washers near the outside edge, and therefore I'm going to synthesize a dielectric material with chunks of metal, cheap washers, in this cheap foam. And that's a kind of meta material that's being studied these days, and that works like a charm. You go the next step beyond that, and you suddenly realize that the lens doesn't have to be all co-located. The lens can be a linear distribution along the boom. And your washers get replaced with directors that have certain lengths and certain positions. And when you do that just right, you end up with a slow wave structure that has different amounts of slow wave at different positions along the boom. When you plot that, it's called the velocity profile. When you have just the right velocity profile, and you combine that with Huygens' principle, you get this beautiful focusing action. You synthesize a great big lens that, if you really built the lens, would be a huge wind load, whereas this Yagi structure is an extremely small wind load by comparison. Yes, you could do that with optics. With optics, the magnifying glass is a much simpler approach. With RF, the Yagi approach is much simpler. And so, I wonder if you've ever heard any of these methods of explaining the way a Yagi works. Fred, K1FC, KQLIW in the TechNet.
No, I haven't. Although, you know, cutting out extra material made me think of a Fresnel lens, which is what you do there. But one story that came to mind, and it was a lesson that drilled into us in college, why you do not leave out data or try to explain. Or make sure you really explain it right. And it was about a guy who was quite famous as a thermodynamicist, but when he was starting out his career, he was involved with measuring very, very precise measurements of the specific heat of hydrogen and trying to establish that the behavior of the hydrogen matched the theory. And he ended up, there was a slight error that he had to fudge out. And so he published something that the specific heat of hydrogen measurements were exactly as predicted, or should be by theory. A little while later, somebody announced the discovery of deuterium. But he said, stop, figure out what that little discrepancy was all about. With that over to you then, that was KWFC.
What if Mel got called away? You there, Mel?
Roger, I'm sorry, I just had to pick up the phone for 1 minute. I missed a little bit of that. So you take it, Dick. I apologize. I just have to answer the phone. My daughter had a question. I'm the answer man. Go ahead, Dick.
Yeah, that's a high priority call. When your daughter calls, and I remember your daughter is in the technical field, there's been a whole lot of cases of somebody missing something by thinking that the data that deviated from the theory was just a maverick or just a experimental error. And in many cases, that experimental error is telling you something. You're throwing out the baby with the washwater when you throw out that maverick piece of data. Kind of amazing to me, getting back to Yagi's, that I know for a fact, everything I know about Fourier series, Fourier transforms, tells me that if you're smart enough with the math, somebody tells you that across your parabolic dish, for instance, this is how strong the signal is on each square inch of the parabolic reflector created by the feed horn when it's transmitting. This is how strong the signal is on each square inch, and this is the phase angle of illumination of each square inch. So therefore, you know the aperture distribution in amplitude and phase. You know the vector at each square centimeter or square inch. I think it's called a tensor field. You know the vector field, which is the tensor, across that surface of the aperture of the dish. From that, a smart person with good Fourier transforms can predict with high accuracy what will the pattern look like. How wide will the main lobe be in E-plane beamwidth, H-plane beamwidth? How strong will the side lobes be? Where the side lobes will be located, and so on. So once you accept that, and I think it's reasonably well accepted theory, you now know in the forward direction, you can take an aperture distribution and predict the complete pattern, at least in the forward hemisphere of that antenna. Conversely, if somebody makes enough measurements of the forward hemisphere of that antenna, presents that data to you in the right format, you can predict what the aperture distribution is. If you accept that, if you accept the inverse transform, which I believe in almost all cases does exist, therefore, when you're tuning a Yagi and you make the assumption that a long Yagi is going to have an aperture distribution that is approximately a circle, and within that circle, if you had uniform distribution, the side lobes would be 17.5 dB down. I and many people have, in the process of tuning a Yagi in your backyard, during the mistuning process, made the side lobes a lot stronger than -17.5 dB down. -13, 12, 11, 10, maybe even -9. I know I've seen -13 because the very popular Yagis in 1972, the Ed Tilden Yagis, W1HDQ, had side lobes approximately 13.5 dB down. And I know you can mistune that and make them stronger yet. If you figure out what that means, it means that with certain setups of those directors of a long Yagi, create a velocity profile that in turn creates an aperture distribution, even though you can't see it. It's the equivalent of a parabolic reflector around that Yagi, even though you can't see it. But the fact that you're able to make the side lobes that strong tells me with rather strong message to me that I'm able to tune that Yagi so that it is edge-weighted. The perimeter of its circular aperture distribution has stronger signals at the perimeter than the center. Of course, that's opposite of common sense. But when you see that pattern, that's a very strong piece of evidence. I think it's there. And if that's true, if these assumptions are all true, it has a very interesting ramification. If I'm now going to build a great big phased array of Yagis, a moon-bound antenna, and I'm going to try to select what is the right spacing between those Yagis, if I have Yagis with low side lobes, which means the edge illumination is very low, I would select a certain spacing of those Yagis so that I don't get too much overlap of those areas. But if I have a particular kind of Yagi where the first side lobes are very strong, that means the edge, the perimeter of the circle of aperture distribution of the Yagi, the effective area, is edge-weighted. It's got a stronger signal at the perimeter than the center of the circle of effective aperture. Those kind of Yagis, if you're not spacing them a little bit further apart, you've now got heavily weighted areas overlapping with each other, and you're throwing away a lot of potential gain. So when it comes to choosing the right stacking distance for Yagis, not only a function of the gain of the Yagi, it's a function of how strong are the side lobes of that particular Yagi design that you're using. You can see where I'm going with this one, Fred. K1FC, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah. Yagis are the one answer that I've spent the least trying to decide. I don't know whether I have in the past, when I had time to fool around with it, did a lot of playing around with wire antennas with EasyNeck and MMANA, which is, I noticed recently, has been updated. You were mentioning earlier about the matching any like sections compared to the Q match, where you would have two impedances. So you'd have a different impedance for a section of like 72 ohms, and you could match at one frequency very nicely an antenna. The MMANA, the original one that I had an error in that program that didn't do it right, but somebody online had one that gave exactly the right answer. Unfortunately, I don't remember who it was, but that was one thing I meant to mention earlier. Over to you, Mal, K1FC.
Okay, thank you, Fred. Very good. This is K2KEY. Good question, Dick. A long boom Yagi, I mean, let's make it an infinite as long as possible, or whatever we need, would it give us the best bandwidth, best front-to-back, front-to-rear ratio, and the best SWR without sacrificing front-to-rear or SWR coverage? In other words, by making the boom longer, let's say we build a Yagi, or how the heck do I phrase it? Let's say we build a Yagi, and we find that we want more bandwidth out of it. We want more front-to-rear ratio. But we don't want to sacrifice the front-to-rear ratio or the SWR coverage of the band. Could we just do that by adjusting the boom length, Dick? In other words, make it a long boom, over.
Yes. Let me break for a second and tell Fred. Fred, if you're in front of a computer, or if you've got a pencil and paper, write down this email address. And that is www.k5rmg.org. RMG stands for Roadrunner Microwave Group, believe it or not. So www.k5rmg, Romeo Mike Golf, .org. And if you want to, you can either go there and look for the technical section, or go directly to it by going to /tech.html. When you do that, you're going to see a series of articles that they have collected. And down at the bottom, you'll see a section by K2RIW on antenna scattering, which gets into some of this. So now to answer your question, Mel, the longest Yagi I know, that's a commercial product made by Directive Systems, K1WHS, Dave O'Lean in Lebanon, Maine. He runs this antenna manufacturing company out of this great big barn in his backyard in Maine. And he manufactures a Yagi for either 2 gigs or 3 gigs, which has 102 elements. When you see a boom on a 3-gig Yagi that is about 12 or 14 feet long, and each of the elements are a couple of inches long, it's a strange-looking structure. And in the old days, when Ed Tilton was coming up with his 13-element Yagi, people used to believe that long Yagis did not work well. But anything beyond 13 elements, you get a low diminishing returns and don't waste your time. Well, back in those days when people believed you chose a director of a certain length and therefore you use the exact same length for all the directors and just keep adding more and more of them, they didn't realize that when you choose a director of a certain length and a certain spacing between the directors, you're synthesizing a magnifying glass with a particular focal length. It's kind of obvious that if you just keep the directors the same length and the spacing the same, and you keep adding more and more of them, what you're really doing is you're moving the magnifying glass further and further forward, and pretty soon it's focusing at a point way in front of the driven element. You're doing a beautiful job of focusing, but your driven element isn't there, and you're not gathering that energy. And the rest of the directors beyond that are doing some kind of scattering. So the bottom line of all this is that when you make the Yagi longer and longer, in general, a substantial percentage of the directors will become shorter. And maybe the spacings will become even a little bit wider. So you're synthesizing a magnifying glass. That's what the slow wave structure out in front of the driven element is doing. All those directors, you're trying to synthesize a magnifying glass with a longer focal length and a bigger diameter. So once you realize that you've got a lot of variables in your hand, every one of those directors can be dithered in length, dithered in polarization, dithered in spacing, dither in diameter, and I recently read an article telling me there's even other ways you can dither them. You can now synthesize any velocity profile. That means a plot of velocity vector versus boom position. So along that boom, you can make any velocity profile that you desire, any graph of velocity versus position. Once you realize you've got that freedom, you can now control within certain limits the forward gain, the side lobe levels, the first, second, third, fourth, fifth side lobe level, quite a bit about the back hemisphere, front to back ratio, front to side ratio, and even something to do with the bandwidth of the antenna. So beam width in as and L, the total pattern in as and L, or H field pattern, E field pattern, side lobes, beam width, side lobe levels, front to back ratios. You've got a lot of variables in your hand. And if you're smart enough with a good enough computer program, you can get a lot. The guy who is probably the best expert on Yagis on planet Earth, Dr. Gunter Hock, DL6WU, Delta Lima 6 Whiskey Uniform. He works for the Research Institute of the German Federal Post Office in Darmstadt, Germany. He has at his disposal this really big, very well-tuned anechoic chamber. I say very well-tuned, I mean it was a high-performance chamber before the beam counters came along and added all kinds of safety railings inside that chamber. And now the safety railings are giving him a bunch of reflections that are a little bit hard for him to live with. But still, for a lot of years he had access to that chamber. And he took everybody's Yagi in the world, boiled it down to a 432 or a 1296 equivalent, measured it, studied it, graphed it, and so he's got published articles in the Dubis magazine, the German magazine, microwave magazine, in which he's published a lot of articles on probably 25, 35 different Yagi designs, different authors, what is their performance. He's got a chart of what is the achievable gain versus boom length. He's boiled it down to a formula. So if you tell me how many wavelengths of boom you've got to work with, his formula, within a couple of percent of accuracy, will tell you what is the maximum gain you will achieve. So gain versus boom length is a reproducible formula. And so his formula he came up with it back in the days when people thought 20 elements was a very long Yagi. All of a sudden, a few years later, guys came out with 30, 40, 50, 70, and 102 element Yagis, and they fit his formula. It's almost like the whose equation is, I can't think of it now, the guy who predicted how many transistors you're going to have in a microprocessor. Guarantee you can think of that name right away. Fred, what's the name of the guy I'm thinking of?
Moore's Law.
That's it. Way back in the mid-60s, Mr. Moore predicted how many transistors you would have on a chip and how fast it's going to expand. I think he said you're going to double the number of transistors on a microprocessor every 18 months. You're going to double the number of lines of code in your computer program every 12 months. These are Moore's laws. And various people throughout the decades were saying, yeah, Moore's law is great. It's fitting like a charm, but it's going to run out of steam. When you get down to the molecular level, it ain't going to happen anymore. So people were predicting we would run out of Moore's law in the late 70s. Then they predicted it for the late 80s. Then they predicted for the late 90s. Now they ain't predicting anymore. Moore's law has continued. We're getting better and better lithography techniques for building microprocessors. We're building longer and more transistors per chip. And so we haven't run out of Moore's law. We haven't run out of the Gunter-Hawk equation. You do a good enough job of tuning those elements. You make them out of low enough loss materials. And his Yagi fitting formula is working beautifully at 102 elements. Let me reverse the order because it was Mel that sort of asked this question. I may have asked answered a slightly different question. Let me pass it back to you, Mel. You pass it over to Fred. K2KEY, K2IW in the TechNet.
Hey, Dick, this is K2KEY. Well, what I was getting back to, what I was really trying to ask is, being that the boom, the length of the boom, is a function of the gain, are you better to make the boom longer or to add elements? In other words, is there really a viable answer? Say, gee, I'll make a beam, say, with four elements, or would I be better off making a three-element beam and just make a longer boom stick? This is basically, is there a trade-off over?
Yeah, now I know what you're asking. On the assumption you stay within certain limits of element length and element spacings and whatever, his formula says that for a certain length of boom, this is the gain you can achieve. You can then achieve that gain on that boom length. You can add a whole lot more elements in that very boom. You will not get more gain. Period. Now, you can go too far in the other direction. You can make a more and more skeleton structure, use less and less elements, and eventually run out of steam. But once you've done a pretty good job of tuning a Yagi of unknown number of elements when you start the design, but you've got 16 feet of boom to work with, and you start stacking elements on there, and you do a real good job with your computer modeling program or your real backyard tuning, and you come up with the Gunter-Hawk gain, I'm going to call it. You could then go and put as many more elements as you want, change the spacing, change the lens, do whatever you want. You may get a little bit more control of front to side, side lobe levels, front to back, or whatever, but you will not get more gain. Maybe that's close to what you were asking. Back to you, Mel.
That's okay, we're in the net mode now. Now, I was just wondering the trade-off. In other words, the trade-off is that if you have a boom of a certain length, you start adding elements onto it, you supposedly are going to get more forward gain. But would you achieve more on that supposedly if you have a boom that fixed length? In other words, you have a situation where you got to keep it like on your property. You can only rotate a certain size antenna, a certain size boom. You have a turning radius of only a certain amount. Are you better off trying to jam more elements onto that boom? Or taking advantage, in other words, squeeze the largest boom, the longest boom on there, and just space the elements out. In other words, which is actually the better way to go? More elements on what you've got, or just lengthen the boom, Dick, over?
If you've got a good design, let me let it beep. If you've got a good design to begin with, Mel, without extending the boom length, you're not going to get more forward gain. That's what his formula and many of his articles, I think, is saying. If you want more gain, you will add more boom and then add more elements and retune all of the elements. Because you've added an extra length, you're now making a magnifying glass, so to speak, with a longer focal length. And you want all that energy to focus itself onto that driven element. That's the only way you can get down the feed line and peg your res meter. You've got to get onto that feed and element. That's the bottom line. So, if you have chosen a boom that's the maximum that your property will let you rotate, and if you do a good design of the elements on it, and you've got the achievable amount of gain, do whatever you want on that boom, add more elements, subtract elements, make them a different kind of element, whatever, you're not going to get more gain than that. It takes a certain length of boom to derive a certain...